total count of top job hopefuls at 11, a large number filled with big and small names. Rishi Sunak tops with the most Tory MP supporters so far, with pro-Brexit Trade Minister Penny Mordaunt coming in second. However, critics say a long drawn-out contest will deepen economic uncertainty amid a cost-of-living crisis.
What we're going to be faced with is more of the same. I mean, clearly, Boris Johnson brought the office of Prime Minister into further disrepute. And I just think that what we have before us are a number of candidates who are all committed to imperialism, all committed to neoliberalism. They're all warmongers at the end of the day. So we're just kind of rearranging the deck chairs rather than actually making any significant difference. It's a case of sort of parliamentary parlour games, really, rather than any meaningful change.
Onlookers also fear that the race is full of candidates who have a track record of concerning policymaking.
Priti Patel in particular, very close to the Zionist entity, had unofficial visits when she was on a ministerial tour when Theresa May was the Prime Minister, and indeed got sacked as a consequence of that. It was Boris Johnson that brought her back in. But, you know, I mean, you just got to go through all the runners and riders. I mean, they've all got a very sort of checkered history, to say the least. At the end of the day, they're Conservatives, and, you know, they support a system which has actually impoverished millions of people in this country.
It's not yet clear who's going to come out on top in this race. However, one thing we do know for sure is that the next Prime Minister of the entire country is going to be decided by a minority group, paying Conservative Party members, much to the frustration of the majority electorate, who won't have a chance to say who the next Prime Minister will be. Robert Carter, London.
Apparently, senior officials inside the European Commission are not celebrating the news that Boris Johnson is to leave No. 10 Downing Street. There is a belief that his successor will still want to break key elements of the Brexit agreement relating to Northern Ireland. The EU accuses the British government of breaking international law by moving to scrap the Northern Ireland Protocol, which is designed to preserve peace in Ireland by preventing physical border checks. Senior EU lawmaker Guy Verhofstadt has tweeted, "Boris Johnson's reign ends in disgrace. Just like his friend Donald Trump. The end of an era of transatlantic populism? Let's hope so. EU-UK relations suffered hugely with Johnson's choice of Brexit. Things can only get better." Analysts we have been speaking to are less optimistic. Members of the public in Brussels have been telling us what they think about Johnson's political demise.
I'm glad to see him gone. I don't think he was the cause of the problem between EU and UK, but it didn't help solve it.
I don't think the position on the Northern Ireland Protocol will change much, unless there's a snap election and then, say, like Labour take over something. I don't think there'll be any change.
Former EU Brexit negotiator Michel Barnier has tweeted, "The departure of Boris Johnson opens a new page in relations with Britain. May it be more constructive, more respectful of commitments made, in particular regarding peace and stability in Northern Ireland, and more friendly with partners in the EU."
We asked the European Commission spokespeople if the EU's legal action against the British government over Northern Ireland might be paused now that Johnson is leaving the stage. They came back with a simple answer: no. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A fresh controversy is building in a Labour-held borough in East London as an embattled Muslim MP fights for her career. Elected as Britain's first hijab-wearing MP in 2019, Absana Begum's career started off well under the former leader Jeremy Corbyn. However, since Keir Starmer took over in 2020, things took an ugly turn, as local members in the safe Labour seat allegedly turned against her. Things became so bad that Begum was recently hospitalised and taken off work sick, following what she claims is a sustained campaign of misogynistic abuse. Despite this, a trigger ballot has now been launched, which aims to bar her from standing in the next election, a move condemned by her allies in Parliament. A former Muslim Labour member believes this may be part of a larger plot by party leadership to remove an MP they just don't like.
Absana Begum was previously subjected to a smear campaign where she was maliciously accused by a Labour council of supposedly committing housing fraud, and she was found not guilty when she was taken to court. And so this is actually the second attempt to destroy her political career. The people going after her are determined to stop anti-imperialists and practicing Muslims from being involved in public life. It isn't simply the case that Keir Starmer is failing to act. I believe that it's highly likely that Keir Starmer's office is directing this campaign of abuse, harassment and vilification against Afsana Begum. And this is part of a broader Islamophobic anti-socialist strategy to rid the Labour Party of anyone who previously supported Jeremy Corbyn and, frankly, to rid the party of practicing Muslims.
The Labour Party hasn't commented on the case so far. Press TV's attempts to reach Begum for further comment was also unsuccessful.
Starmer has been condemned by various Labour groups over conducting so-called purges of left-wing members who joined the party under Corbyn. Muslims as well feel very persecuted over their views on issues such as criticism of Israel and Palestine solidarity. The fact that Labour's first ever hijab-wearing MP also feels abused will likely deepen Muslim resentment in the party going forward. Robert Carter, London.
The road to Lysychansk, the most recent city taken by the Russians, it's strewn with the debris of war and feels like a post-apocalyptic wasteland. The small settlement of Toshkivka, there's so much destruction it's uninhabitable. One of a few villages we pass that may, quite literally, be wiped off the map.
Now, we're on the road to Lysychansk at the moment, but we've hit a problem. We've come to this part of the road where there's a bridge. The bridge is destroyed. So it looks like we're going to have to find another way around a detour.
The Ukrainians have blown up many such bridges in order to slow the Russian advance. We reach Lysychansk. Remarkably, much of it remains intact, as the Ukrainians gave up this city without much of a fight, although the central administration district saw the worst of the fighting.
I went outside and saw a car driving with the letter Z on it. And there was a pro-Russian militia guy. He climbed up there, took off the Ukrainian flag, and hung the Russian flag, the flag of victory. And our joy began. People came to see the flag and they were happy. They were crying, laughing, and dancing. It was great, and I still feel this joy. I think it'll remain with me forever.
A statue commemorating the fallen Soviet soldiers during World War II. Ukrainians extinguished the eternal flame in an effort to expunge Russian culture from the city. It will be lit again soon. Now the city is under Russian control.
When it was Ukraine here, we lived, somehow. There were several incidents, like my wife owned a small hairdresser's. Once a man from some nationalist battalion came and made her speak Ukrainian. He was shouting and even kicked her. They took me away for questioning a few times. It was Ukrainization here. I'm Russian, and I was born here. They were trying to force us to assimilate.
They consider people here in Donbas subhuman. I always wondered whether we had horns or something. We were second-class citizens. One Ukrainian soldier who was born only 50 kilometers away from me asked me why I hadn't left to Russia. They told us all the time to leave. But why? I've lived here all my life. My parents died here. My daughter lives here. He told me I was pro-Russian and so I should leave. They treat us with hatred.
The Russian army has set up a museum on the street. Tanks and weapons taken from the retreating Ukrainian army. There are British N-Laws and American javelins, as well as an array of drones that have increasingly become an essential part of modern warfare.
We all have to work to restore our town. Those who can't work will work. Everybody. Old-age pensioners say they'll work anywhere if it's necessary. We will rebuild our town. It'll be great.
While this war is bringing devastation to the towns and cities in which the two armies meet, it also leaves behind a desire for peace and a determination for these people to rebuild their cities and their lives. Johnny Miller, Lysychansk.
Touting South Korea's nuclear technology to allies at a recent summit in Europe, President Yoon Suk-yeol will increase the country's nuclear energy production and boost reactor sales abroad. The previous administration began to phase out nuclear power following the Fukushima nuclear disaster, problems with South Korea's aging reactors, and industry corruption. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol's decision to reverse course and ramp up nuclear power comes as the country faces multiple challenges to meeting its energy requirements. South Korea imports almost 100% of its oil, leaving it open to costly crude price fluctuations. And rising temperatures have increased energy demand here to record levels. The government will resume suspended reactor construction, with nuclear generating 30% of the country's energy mix by 2030. The Yoon administration says the move will help the country reach carbon neutrality and create jobs. Environmentalists decry the policy turnabout.
Nuclear technology is inherently risky, and it's also expensive, and also it's not a good solution for climate change.
South Korea ranks last in the OECD in renewable energy production, such as solar, wind, and geothermal, which activists view as offering viable alternatives.
To replace fossil fuels without increasing nuclear and provide all the electricity needed with the renewables, that's a challenge. But based on the analysis from the governmental institutions, the renewable energy potential for South Korea is enough to provide all the electricity we need.
South Korea plans to export 10 nuclear reactors by 2030, currently vying for projects planned in Poland and the Czech Republic. Officials also this week announced funding for new small modular reactor, SMR, development. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After spending a night in Muzdalifa, a town between Mina and Arafat, and collecting 49 pebbles for the next day's stoning of the devil ritual, Muslims marched in a great procession to the city of tents, Mina. The stoning of the devil ritual includes stoning three pillars which symbolize the devil and the sins. On Eid al-Adha, pilgrims headed to Jamarat Bridge, where they threw seven pebbles at one of the three pillars that symbolize the devil. Then they returned to Mina, offering sacrifices. The animal is butchered and its meat is packed and shipped to other countries or is fed to the poor. After that, men shave their heads. This act symbolizes one's detachment from physical appearances and complete subjection to God.
It is a symbol of killing all negative things inside you. It teaches us to clean our hearts from every kind of darkness. Therefore, that is why we throw the stones.
On the 11th and 12th days of Hajj, pilgrims must complete the stoning of the devil by throwing seven pebbles at each pillar in Jamarat.
After decades of fighting, victims and the families of those impacted by the Factor VIII blood contamination scandal could be headed for compensation of sorts. In one of the darkest periods for Britain's National Health Service, a shortage of clotting agents for haemophiliacs and others suffering from other blood disorders meant the country imported blood products from the US. It later emerged the blood had been distilled from a wide range of people, including prisoners, and had been poorly screened. An investigation led by former judge Sir Brian Langstaff was announced by ex-Prime Minister Theresa May back in 2017 and seems to be finally approaching its conclusion. Earlier this month, one of the ministers at the centre of the scandal, John Major, was forced to apologise after saying the victims had incredibly bad luck. Major had previously written that it was unwise to give a sympathetic view to the victims, as this might open the government up to culpability, a view that disgusts those still working with patients.
Even more damaging than the actual medical error itself, and you know, I'm a doctor, I've been involved in medical error, it's an inevitable part of life, an inevitable part of medical practice, but the attitude towards that transparency and honesty and admission of mistakes to prevent further harm being done is at the heart of good medical ethics. And what we see here is at the highest governmental level, an open admission that there was knowledge, but action wouldn't be taken either to acknowledge the error, to take steps to stop further people being infected, perhaps. And certainly, at the heart of all of this was the worry about money.
Due to medical advances and the more robust fashion in which blood products are screened before even getting to the patient, the likelihood of another Factor 8 scandal is highly unlikely. But according to experts, the race to weaken the NHS means another health crisis is just around the corner. Representatives of the current government have pledged to abide by the results and recommendation of the probe. But for many of those affected and the loved ones they've left behind, anything will be too little, too late. Amina Taylor, London.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Small teams of U.S. Special Operations Forces are involved in a low-profile proxy war program on a far greater scale than previously known, according to exclusive documents and interviews with more than a dozen current and former government officials. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Nick Turse and Alice Sperry, authors. This article is published under the heading, How the Pentagon Uses a Secretive Program to Wage Proxy Wars. Stay tuned for the first part of this article, please. Small teams of U.S. Special Operations Forces are involved in a low-profile proxy war program on a far greater scale than previously known, according to exclusive documents and interviews with more than a dozen current and former government officials. While The Intercept and other outlets have previously reported on the Pentagon's use of the secretive 127E authority in multiple African countries, a new document obtained through the Freedom of Information Act offers the first official confirmation that at least 14 127E programs were also active in the West Asia and Asia-Pacific regions as recently as 2020. In total, between 2017 and 2020, U.S. commandos conducted at least 23 separate 127E programs across the world. Separately, Joseph Votel, a retired four-star Army general who headed both the Special Operations Command and Central Command, which oversees U.S. military efforts in the West Asia region, confirmed the existence of previously unrevealed 127E counterterrorism efforts in Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, and Yemen. Another former senior defense official who requested anonymity to discuss a classified program confirmed that an earlier version of the 127E program had also been in place in Iraq. A 127E program in Tunisia, codenamed Obsidian Tower, which has never been acknowledged by the Pentagon or previously identified as a use of 127E authority, resulted in combat by U.S. forces alongside local surrogates in 2017, according to another set of documents obtained by The Intercept. A third document, a secret memo that was redacted and declassified for release to The Intercept, sheds light on hallmarks of the program, including use of authority to provide access to areas of the world otherwise inaccessible even to the most elite U.S. troops. The documents and interviews provide the most detailed picture yet of an obscure funding authority that allows American commandos to conduct counterterrorism operations by with and through foreign and irregular partner forces around the world. Basic information about these missions, where they are conducted, their frequency and targets, and the foreign forces the U.S. relies on to carry them out, are unknown even to most members of relevant congressional committees and key State Department personnel. Through 127E, the U.S. arms, trains, and provides intelligence to foreign forces. But unlike traditional foreign assistance programs, which are primarily intended to build local capacity, 127E partners are then dispatched on U.S.-directed missions, targeting U.S. enemies to achieve U.S. aims. The foreign participants in a 127 ECHO program are filling gaps that we don't have enough Americans to fill. A former senior defense official involved with the program told The Intercept, adding, if someone were to call a 127 ECHO program a proxy operation, it would be hard to argue with them. Retired generals with intimate knowledge of the 127E program, known in military parlance as 127 ECHO, say that it is extremely effective in targeting militant groups while reducing risk to U.S. forces. But experts told The Intercept that use of the little-known authority raises grave accountability and oversight concerns and potentially violates the U.S. Constitution. One of the documents obtained by The Intercept puts the cost of 127E operations between 2017 and 2020 at $310 million, a fraction of U.S. military spending over that time period, but a significant increase from $25 million budget allocated to the program when it was first authorized under a different name in 2005. Critics contend that due to a lack of oversight, 127E programs risk involving the United States in human rights abuses and entangling the U.S. in foreign conflicts, unbeknownst to Congress and the American people. Former commanders say the 127E authority is crucial to combating terrorism. For more than a year, the White House has failed to provide The Intercept with substantive comment about operations by U.S. commandos outside conventional war zones, and specifically failed to address the use of 127E programs. Critics of 127E warned that in addition to the risk of unanticipated military escalation and the potential cost of engaging in up to a dozen conflicts around the world, some operations may amount to an unlawful use of force. Because most members of Congress, including those directly responsible for overseeing foreign affairs, have no input and little visibility into where and how the programs are run. 127E-related hostilities can lack the congressional authorization required by the U.S. Constitution, argued Catherine Ebright, counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice. There is reason to suspect the Department of Defense has used 127E partners to engage in combat beyond the scope of any authorization for the use of military force or permissible self-defense, Ebright told The Intercept, noting substantial confusion at the Pentagon and in Congress over a stipulation that 127E programs support only authorized ongoing military operations. Adding, that kind of unauthorized use of force, even through partners rather than U.S. soldiers themselves, would contravene constitutional principles. The origins of the 127E program can be traced back to the earliest days of the U.S. war in Afghanistan, as commandos and CIA personnel sought to support the Afghan Northern Alliance in its fight against the militants. Army Special Operations Command soon realized that it lacked the authority to provide direct payments to its new proxies and was forced to rely on CIA funding. This prompted a broader push by SOCOM to secure the ability to support foreign forces in so-called missions, a military corollary to the CIA's use of militia surrogates. First known to Section 1208, the authority was also deployed in the early years of the Iraq invasion. According to a former senior defense official, it was ultimately enshrined in U.S. law under USC Title 10, 127E. 127E is one of the several virtually unknown authorities granted to the Defense Department by Congress over the last two decades that allow U.S. commandos to conduct operations on the fringes of war and with minimal outside oversight. With 127E focuses on counterterrorism, other authorities allow elite forces, Navy SEALs, Army Green Berets, and Marine Raiders among them, to conduct clandestine intelligence and counterintelligence operations or assist foreign forces in irregular warfare, primarily in the context of so-called great power competition. In April, top special operations officials unveiled a new vision and a strategy framework that appears to endorse continued reliance on the 127E concept by leveraging burden-sharing partnerships to achieve objective within an acceptable level of risk. General Richard D. Clark, the current Special Operations Commander, testified before Congress in 2019 that 127E programs directly resulted in the capture or killing of thousands of terrorists, disrupted terrorist networks and activists, and denied terrorists operating space across a wide range of operating environments at a fraction of the cost of other programs. Clark's claims cannot be verified. A SOCOM spokesperson told The Intercept that the command does not have figures on those captured or killed during 127E missions. It is also not known how many foreign forces and civilians have been killed in these operations. But a former defense official confirmed to The Intercept that there have been U.S. casualties, even as U.S. troops are traditionally expected to stay behind last cover and concealment during a foreign partner's operations. The documents obtained by The Intercept tout the importance of the authority, particularly in providing U.S. special operators a way into difficult-to-access areas. According to a memo, 127E program provided the only human physical access to areas with local partners focused on finding, fixing, and finishing enemy forces. Another 127E program targeting Al-Qaeda and its affiliates similarly allowed commandos to project combat power into previously inaccessible VEO or violent extremist organization safe havens.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight. We'll be right back.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. U.S. President Joe Biden will be traveling to Saudi Arabia and Israel this week for his first official visit to the region since taking office. Now, ahead of the controversial visit, we will dissect the failures that the U.S. has experienced in its foreign policy in this region in the past several years. Now, my guests for tonight's episode of the Spotlight are journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who's joining us out of Marseille, France. Also with us will be journalist and author Daniel Lazar. He's in New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Now over to Marseille. Elijah, let's begin with Syria. You know, just last week we had this report that American forces were escorting a number of tankers. They were carrying, stealing actually, Syrian oil out of the country. So also, you know, Washington tried to oust the president in Syria by, you know, backing terrorists, but to no avail. So the question is, what was the reason for Washington and also its regional and NATO allies' failure to meet their objectives in Syria?
Thank you for having me.
Sure thing.
It's obvious that President Joe Biden has no policy or strategy to adopt in Syria, but following exactly what Donald Trump has established by occupying northeast Syria and stealing the oil. Furthermore, he blocked the road between on the borders of Tanf between Syria and Iraq, to cripple the Syrian economy and continue imposing the Caesar Act sanctions, very harsh sanctions on Syria, to cripple the economy and to hit the population, because sanctions are always against the population, regime or government. Therefore, we can understand that Biden doesn't have any strategy in the Middle East, doesn't have any clear strategy in Syria. It is indeed stealing the oil, particularly in this moment where the war in Ukraine is weighing very heavily on the West and is creating a shortage of energy and an increase of prices. Although in Iraq, too, Biden is not in the best position, where the Iraqi parliament has asked him to leave the country and for the U.S. forces to and their presence, according to a clear decision by the Iraqi people. And yet we still see the Americans are still in Iraq, are still in Syria. They're not leaving against the will of the population,
right?
Because Biden simply doesn't have any strategy.
Okay, we'll come to Iraq also on the show. Okay, now let me ask Daniel about another country in this region where the U.S. foreign policy has failed, Afghanistan. Just recently, you know, the forces that were supposed to achieve the stated goal of nation building, they left that country in ruins. And for the United States, the war in Afghanistan was the most protracted one in history, you know, 20 years, longer than World War I, World War II, and the Vietnam War combined. So what do you think the reason is for the U.S. failure in Afghanistan?
It's a very good question. And the answer is there really is no answer. I mean, the U.S. went into Afghanistan after 9/11 merely to demonstrate that it could, as a show of force. It didn't have to. It was on a a campaign to demonstrate that it would, you know, it would not stand for any more terrorist attacks, but it did so by waging war against a government that was only peripherally involved in 9/11. So there was no good reason. It was just a pointless display of force. And once the U.S. got in there, there was no getting out. So the U.S. spent 20 years, it's astonishing, the U.S. spent 20 years, essentially, trying to figure out what to do next. And in the process, when it was all finished and was finally lost control and was finally forced out, it left the country in far worse shape than it found it. So, you know, I mean, so over the course of 20 years, from 1978, when the U.S. started funneling aid to the Afghan Mujahideen, to mid-2021, when it was finally forced to leave, the U.S. just pummeled that country, destroyed it, leveled, one attack after the other. First, in order to dislodge the Soviets, and then secondly, just to sort of show that it was, the biggest, most powerful military power in the area. It's a completely bizarre process that historians will be scratching their head over, I guarantee, for generations to come.
Okay. Now, Elijah, you talked about Iraq, so I was going to also ask you about Iraq, and let's now explore the reason or reasons why the Iraqi parliamentarians are wary of U.S.-led force in their country. You know, they want them out.
For the simple reason, because the Americans have violated every single mandate and agreement signed with the Iraqi government. They're not supposed to send drones. They're not supposed to fly over Iraq or do any military act without the coordination with the Iraqi military and the Iraqi army, and at least the chief of the Iraqi army, that is the prime minister. And we have seen how Donald Trump ignored completely the prime minister of Iraq then, Adel Abdel Mahdi, when the defense minister, Minister Esper, used to call Abdel Mahdi and say, we're going to strike your forces at this point in 20 minutes. And then the prime minister would say, well, you have no right. He said, I'm not asking your authorization. I'm just informing you what we are going to do. Mm-hmm. The U.S. forces killed dozens of Iraqi security forces by bombing their positions. Furthermore, they've killed the Iranian general Qasem Soleimani when he was acting as an ambassador and an advisor to Iraq. And he came to Iraq to the request of the prime minister, again putting Iraq in a very weird position between with Iran, where an ambassador and a general is killed on its territory without the knowledge of the Iraqi. So all these violations that continued throughout the years with the American on Iraqi soil, and then the Iraqi army is trained enough and capable with the Hashdi Shaabi to counter ISIS and all the Takfiri, there is no more reason for the American forces to remain. So now they are illegally in the country.
Yeah, and let's not forget, Elijah, that General Soleimani was not a regular general. He was also helping the Iraqis get rid of Daesh. Okay, Daniel, during a presidential campaign in his early days at the Oval Office, Joe Biden used to call Saudi Arabia a pariah state, and he planned to recalibrate and look into U.S. relations with the Arab monarchy. And, you know, Saudi Arabia has been behind 9/11 attacks. It has a long list of human rights violations recorded. So what's the reason for Biden's turnabout?
Well, really, it's oil. Actually, it's two things. It's oil, it's control of the Persian Gulf, and it's Iran. Three things. I mean, essentially, the U.S. has been in a partnership with Saudi Arabia since February 1945, when Franklin D. Roosevelt had his famous meeting with King Ibn Saud on the Great Salt Lake in the Suez Canal, the U.S. gave the Saudis an unqualified guarantee of security in exchange for their oil, and over the years, Saudi Arabia has turned that security guarantee into an all-purpose carte blanche to attack whatever country it sees fit. So therefore, Saudi Arabia has attacked Yemen. It has fostered a proxy war in Syria. It's threatened to invade Qatar. And the U.S. essentially has done nothing to stop it. It's even encouraged it at various points.
Mm-hmm. Now, Elijah, also we have U.S.-made weapons that are being used by Saudi mercenaries to take the life of Yemeni women and children. And still, the U.S. keeps selling them weapons. And 7-8 years pass, and Saudis and their allies, including the U.S., have failed to bring the impoverished nation and the Yemenis to their knees, haven't they?
President Biden failed in all his promises and lied about everything he said during his campaign. Because although he pledged to make Saudi Arabia a pariah and promised to teach dictators a lesson not to supply arms to Saudis and to stop the Saudi war in Yemen and to comply with the JCPOA, he has done nothing of all that. He's going to supply weapons to Saudi Arabia. The ceasefire is really hectic in Yemen, and still Yemen is as poor as it was before 18 months when he took power. And there is no JCPOA that has been implemented so far. So whatever Biden said he's going to do, he's not doing it. And as your guest rightly said, he's coming for the oil, but not for the security in the Persian Gulf, because the security in the Persian Gulf is looked after by its own people and country. And we have seen how the Americans, the British, the Israeli, and the Greek failed to impose their will on Iran in the Strait of Hormuz, and Iran showed that it is Iran that is in control of 19% of the world energy that goes through that passage. Therefore, what Biden said, that the water is very important for the Americans and its allies to keep control of it, is against a mockery, because he's not in control of the water in the Strait of Hormuz.
Mm-hmm. Now, Daniel, let's talk a little bit now about the Iran nuclear deal, or JCPOA. You know, marathon talks between Iran, the U.S., and its European allies resulted in what many called a landmark deal. And the U.S. simply scrapped it. And it even threatened other parties not to follow, not to abide by the deal. And this is another failure on the diplomatic front, isn't it?
Oh, it's a failure. It is a colossal foul-up. And Biden's attitude has been ridiculous. I mean, Biden is just utterly contemptible. The Democrats attacked Donald Trump when he walked away from the treaty in May 2018. They vowed to restore the treaty, which, after all, was negotiated by Barack Obama and Joe Biden back in 2015. So it's Joe Biden's handiwork. But then when Joe Biden came into office and began negotiations with Iran, he introduced additional demands which were completely outside the purview of the JCPOA, which he knew that Iran could not possibly abide by. Mm-hmm. So Biden, after calling for the restoration of the treaty that he and Barack Obama negotiated, set about sabotaging those negotiations. It's completely ridiculous. And as a result, military tensions are rising. The possibility of some kind of military engagement is increasing in that region. And the treaty itself was keeping the peace. It was doing its job. Iran, according to all reports, was abiding faithfully by its terms. It was the U.S. which sabotaged that agreement.
Mm-hmm. Elijah, let's also have your thoughts on the JCPOA.
Well, there is a very good point here not to forget. Mm-hmm. And it used to go, and people are unaware of, is that Barack Obama and Joe Biden in 2015 did not implement the JCPOA. They implemented some part of it, and Obama instructed all the banks not to deal with Iran. So the habit of no compliance by the U.S. Mm-hmm. goes back from the moment that the JCPOA was signed, and is not new to the Americans to revoke their signature and their promises and the international treaty. So what Donald Trump did is he dismantled the 2015 that was not fully implemented. And today, Joe Biden is walking along the same road as Barack Obama, not implementing fully the JCPOA, and Donald Trump rejecting it completely and trying to postpone it. Let's see after this trip, because now he's promoting a narrative saying the real enemy is Iran, which is very boring and old and is no longer valid, because the government and the regime in the Middle East are meeting together and are talking and do not consider Iran as the enemy they should fight, because they tried all kind of war in Yemen and in Syria and in Iraq, and this language has failed, is behind us.
Daniel, the U.S. So-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran failed to bring its intended results. That was breaking Tehran's will. Iran resisted what American officials themselves called the most crippling sanctions ever. And Iran even made headways in, you know, in peaceful nuclear technology and nanotechnology and defense industry and other areas. Let's have your take on that.
Well, yes. I mean, sanctions never really work as promised. They're a very blunt instrument. They end up hurting the mass of the population more than they affect the economic elite. And they often, curiously enough, often have strangely positive side effects. For example, I mean, Iran, because international trade was restricted, I mean, essentially was forced to diversify its economy and to concentrate on building its economy up. And as a result, Iran has now the most diverse economy in the Persian Gulf region, certainly a thousand times more than Saudi Arabia, which is just a economic basket case. So as with Russia, these sanctions tend to backfire. The U.S., you know, always brags about them, uses them. I think the U.S. has sanctions against 30 countries at this point. But they're just never as effective as they are supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Elijah, there is another country in the region, Lebanon, that's also been feeling this pinch of U.S. sanctions and interference. Let's talk a little bit about Lebanon and what the U.S. has been doing there.
The U.S. has been trying to break Lebanon's back economically and to make sure that Lebanon doesn't represent a danger to Israel any longer. Because of the presence of the resistance in Lebanon, the country is resisting any deal with Israel over the maritime borders, that Israel wants to take a chunk of the Lebanese wealth and on the border between Palestine and Lebanon. So because of the rejection of Lebanon to submit to the U.S. dictate, and because the U.S. is not a valid partner for peace and a good negotiator, this is why Lebanon refused to sign the deal with the Israelis indirectly. Therefore, the Americans turned the population and try to turn the population against the resistance that is Hezbollah. Luckily, it has failed, because the root cause of all the financial problems in Lebanon are all from the U.S. allies, who stole the money and the wealth of the country, encouraged by the Americans, who put heavy debts on Lebanon and dry out all the dollars from the Lebanese market to make sure that the Lebanese currency will fall into bits. And the Americans succeeded, where inflation hit its record and the local currency is devalued to its maximum never seen before. However, the population did not surrender, and the U.S. failed in its attempt to break Lebanon's back. We cannot exclude the fact that in Lebanon, the U.S. has some influence over a part of the leaders who still are afraid to say no to the Americans. This is why the Lebanese government has rejected these offered by Russia and China to rebuild the local infrastructure, and were submitted to the U.S. will to refuse these offers, although the U.S. offered nothing. So what we have today is the American no strategy in Lebanon but to create a weak country without driving it to the edge of the abyss, but without pushing it to allowing the country to restore and to regain its strength. Because with a strong Lebanon, then Lebanon can say no to Israel and stand against the Israelis stronger than ever.
Okay. Now, Daniel, we've talked about several countries in the West Asia region and the U.S. foreign policy and how it's been working there. So if we want to just sum it up in a nutshell, what's the plan? What is it that Washington is trying to achieve in the West Asia region? Is it stability, instability? And any difference who is at the helm at the Oval Office, whether it's Biden or Trump or whoever?
The second question is a lot easier than the first. It does not make any difference who was at the helm, except for the fact that that Donald Trump had been committed to more isolationist policies, and the Democrats turn out to be much more aggressive, much more imperialistic than the Republicans these days. So that is the big difference. But otherwise, no, empires run on oil, and they are about, you know, all about exerting their power. Now, as to what the U.S. goals are in the Persian Gulf, I mean, essentially, the U.S. policy is driven by Israel and Saudi Arabia. So the U.S. will do whatever those two countries wanted to. And even though the U.S. doesn't import very much oil from the Persian Gulf these days, if any, in fact, the U.S. wants to maintain control of the Persian Gulf because it believes that whoever controls Persian Gulf oil controls the global energy market. And so therefore, it doesn't want China or Russia from assuming that role. So the U.S. feels it's very important to maintain a finger in that pie, just to keep China out.
All right, Elijah, we have only 30 seconds for your final thoughts. Go ahead.
I think the Biden visit to the Middle East is going to be very poor. He is going to go back with a little bit of oil, but not what he dreams about. Mm. He is not the first to take a plane from Tel Aviv to Saudi Arabia, because Netanyahu did that in 2020, and he's not going to achieve what he declared about Iran or about the NATO, Arab NATO, or to bring countries together, whatever. He wants oil because he imposed sanctions on Russia that is hitting him and all his Western allies.
Okay, thank you so much. Elijah Magnier in Marseille, Daniel Lazar in New York.